Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed and everyone can listen to it and enjoy it. Except this week. Today's episode, a little bit different because I don't really want to talk too much about the book. In fact, this is probably going to be the shortest episode on record. A bit of news. I'm at the French juggling convention and I'm hanging out and doing a lot of stuff and I don't really have time to think a lot about this book and review it. It's been a while since I finished it. And then since I finished this book, I finished another book, which is Solaris by Stanislav Lem. And then I've started another book on audiobook, which is I have it here. It's the Alistair Reynolds book, Terminal World. So this book is a few episodes. It should have been released a while ago, or I've done a few books since then. And instead of trying to hold three books in my head and things that I want to say about three books in my head all at once, I've decided to just do a throwaway episode here. And the reason for that is the book is the first book in a trilogy. And it doesn't have an ending, and that's really tricky. The book that I would have reviewed here is called The Judging Eye by R. Scott Bakker, and it's difficult to review a book in a series without spoiling the previous books in it. So the way it works is that R. Scott Bakker wrote another series of books, a trilogy of books called the Prince of Nothing series. It started with The Darkness That Comes Before. It moves on to A Warrior Prophet, or The Warrior Prophet, or The Prophet Warrior. Can't remember which way around. And then finishes off with The Thousandfold Thought. And it tells a story of, you know, fantasy world. Someone comes away. He goes on a quest. His name is Kellis. Let's just follow his story. There's a holy war taking place, and the second book follows the first book follows the holy war coming together as sort of like the start of a crusade, one of the crusades coming together and meeting at Constantinople, and the people in Constantinople trying to stop the hungry soldiers outside trying to sack the city for food and things like that. And the second book follows the story of the crusade and Kellis sort of trying to take over the crusade, this religious conflict. And the third book shows how he sort of does take over the crusade and then turns it and bends it to his will in the final battle in the Thousandfold Thought. And there's lots of other stuff going on there as well. Now, this book picks up, the Judging Eye, picks up 20 years later. So it's really difficult for me to discuss this book in a lot of depth without spoiling the first book and the first trilogy and saying what the characters do at the end of the first trilogy, because it's really tricky. I mean, how am I going to say what Achaemenid is doing in this book without spoiling the previous one? And one thing I do pride myself on is talking about these books without spoilers. And I just don't think I can talk too much about this book without spoiling the previous series too much, which is a bit tricky because a lot of things that happen in these series of books, you know, they refer back to previous things. So just a few little things. I did enjoy the book. However, it doesn't have an end, like I said before. But I didn't mind reading it because the new book has come out. Let me tell you, explain my thought process here. When the first book in the series, of the previous series, The Darkness That Comes Before, when that came out, I knew that the whole trilogy had been finished. And when I finished the book, the whole story to be finished and everything like that. And in many ways, the whole series was finished by the end of the third book, but there was this one quite large part which hadn't been finished, and it was about the consult. And I thought that would be wrapped up by the end of the third book, but it wasn't. And I can see now that that's what this new Aspect Emperor trilogy is going to be all about, is about like humanity's fight with the consult, which is this sort of like weird mythical alien kind of race which is traipsing across the northern reaches and raping everyone in their path. This first book in this second series came out, The Judging Eye came out, and I heard people say that it doesn't have a very good ending. The conclusion doesn't come to a a satisfying, it doesn't need to be a tidy conclusion, but at least a satisfying conclusion to the book. No such satisfying conclusion there at all. But then the second book came out, and it's called The White Luck Worry. It came out a few months ago, and from reports from the people who read it say, yes, that does have a good ending. It does have a satisfying ending. So I thought, okay, I will start the second series knowing that there, at least at one of the books, there will be a satisfying ending. So I did read this book, The Judging Eye. I enjoyed it thoroughly. There's lots of characters that come back again and new characters, and we spend time with them. It's quite long. And there's a lot of stuff going on, but I really enjoyed spending time. However, it wasn't that satisfying because there's lots of things set up. There's lots of, like say, the new characters that get introduced, we're like, oh, this is a new character. What's he going to do? And then that character does one thing, and then we don't really find out what happens, the fallout from this one event, this one thing that this one character does. And then there's other people going on a journey. Oh, there's another big people setting off, big groups of armies setting off and traipsing across long distance. Now, this is the cool thing. In the first book, this holy war, or in the first series, this holy war that set off, this was like a massive part of the book. These people, these massive armies trying to get across deserts and trying to fight their way across enemy territory and trying to find supplies along the way and sacking cities along the way and burning cities. Everything that they needed to do was just to try and keep this army alive as it fought, as it managed to get its way across down to Jerusalem. Well, not Jerusalem, but you know, the destination of the crusade that they were going on. And in this book, we have the similar kind of thing, but now humanity is all banding together to go and fight the consult. And they say, well, we're going to get set off in this big thing, but now our inhuman, godlike mastermind, Kellus, is in charge of this whole operation. And it's a really strange thing that, like, he's like this fascist dictator. And the one thing that they say about the fascist dictators is like, oh, well, they make the trains run on time. You know, and the Germans all are very organized and things like that. And, you know, they do genocide, but they do it very well. I know that's a weird thing to say, but that's what you have in this book. They call it the Great Ordeal. And it doesn't even seem that much of an ordeal. It's lots of people just traipsing across the steps and they're going at a sedate pace and everyone's well supplied and everyone's got enough to eat. Unlike the first series where the whole book was about trying to provision an army as it went across the desert. Now they're going across the steppes and it's like, oh yeah, it's fine. We'll have enough water. We'll have enough food. And when we don't, we'll all split up and we'll all range. So it's a completely different, like completely opposite of the journey as the first book. And I think that's because, you know, you have this godlike being who knows exactly what he's doing and he appoints generals. He's like supremely rational in everything that he does and is very good at organizing. And then there's these other characters, Achaemenion. He's trying to get to another place. I can't remember what it's called, but this library that was burnt down, and he wants to find some secret in this library. So he gets together with some mercenaries and they set off across the wastelands as well. But instead of setting off with the massive army or alongside the massive army, they're trying to avoid the massive army because this is more of a secret mission. And so they're trying to set off. And the only way that they can get there is through the Mines of Moria. And you might think, wait a second, isn't the Mines of Moria, isn't that part of Lord of the Rings? Yeah, but we get a complete rip-off. Well, maybe rip-off, maybe a homage, maybe a tribute to the Mines of Moria sequence. We get that about half of the book. Maybe a quarter of the book is spent with these people in the Mines of Moria. And I enjoyed it in a way because it was like a different take, but it did seem to be like, well, I could just say, okay, they're going to go into mines. What are they going to find? What's going to happen? Well, they're going to find a Balrog. They're going to find orcs. They're going to find whatever they, you know, in the same thing that we found in Mines of Moria. They're going to lose people and people are going to come back and they're going to, you know, some of the members actually in the Fellowship of the Rings, did anyone die except Gandalf? I don't know. Ooh, spoiler. Anyway, but when they go into the Mines of the Moria, there's going to be gribblers, there's going to be, you know, halls, there's going to be holes in the ground and all this kind of thing. And it is fun to read, but it did feel a bit like well-trod ground. But yeah, I guess R. Scott Bakker is going with this this trope of fantasy just hitting it head on and going, yes, now I'm going to do Tolkien. Are you liking this Tolkien bit? Yeah. And there's also bits with Kellus's children, because this is set 20 years after the first series. So 20 years later, his children have grown up, so we get to spend some time with them. Some of his older, his first sons, and then his youngest sons as well. Kel Nomas, who is like a young Kellus, like a little precocious, pretentious kid who also realizes that he has some godlike abilities as well, that he's kind of in some weird Lamarckian way inherited from his father. But then again, his father was, in the same way, to just take it back to a comparison with another book that I found, this is very much like Dune. So in Dune, you get Paul Atreides, who becomes Mor Dib and becomes the emperor. He gets his godlike powers because they've been bred into him by the Bene Gesserit for thousands of generations, and he's been trained as a mentat. That is what Kellus is very much like. He has been bred over many, many generations. He's been trained from birth to become like a mentat. What do they call it? I can't even remember what the name of the Kwasix Haderach, or whatever they call it in Dune. That is what he has become, because he's been refined over generations, and all of his upbringing has been towards that end. And that's what you get at the end of Dune. So he becomes the Emperor at the end of Dune, and that's sort of what happened at the end of the Prince of Nothing series. And then you've got Dune Messiah, which is set, you know, years later when he's consolidated his empire. All of that, you don't really need to read about that. And that's what happens in this book as well. Kellis has already consolidated his empire. We don't need to read about him conquering all the planets or conquering all the different things. What we can then find out about is his next big steps as an emperor, the next most important thing that's going to happen to him. And that's what we have here as well. So we do get the kind of Children of Dune, Dune Messiah, God Emperor of Dune kind of thing going on, where this one dynasty is continuing through, and the offspring are also just as powerful, or not just as powerful, but powerful in different ways. And there's a whole conflict of, okay, I have this power, and what am I going to do with this power? And then on top of that, we do get these other ideas coming in. We get a lot more mysticism in here, because all of the things that were suppressed under the religious different factions of religion. You had the monotheistic Kiyan religion, which is sort of like the Islamic kind of religion, and then you got like the polytheistic Tusk religion, where there's all these different, you know, the 100 schools, or is it 1,000 schools? I can't remember, but there's every different caste and every different level of society has a different god that they're worshipping. And now that is no longer being controlled in the same way. Really, Kellis is controlling that. He says, okay, well, now all these other religions which were being suppressed, let's just bring them out all in the open, because I'm now the godhead and everyone's going to look up to me. So it doesn't matter what you were before. So everyone can come out the woodwork. So now in this book, you find out about all of the suppressed religions and all of the suppressed factions and things. They're all sort of coming out of the woodwork. And again, we had that same idea. If you stick with the Dune series, you get to book 5 or book 6, get to Chapter House Dune, and what was the other one? I can't even remember. But you find out the same kind of thing, that the Jews are still there. And you're thinking, well, the Jews, yeah. Well, the Jews have been like that, you know, the Jews that we have in the world today, they still survive into the, you know, thousands of hundreds or tens of thousands of years into the future of Dune, through the machine wars, through the Butlerian jihad and all that kind of stuff. The Jews are still there under the surface, and then they sort of bubble out later on in the series. And that's what you have here, sort of a broadening of the religious spectrum, a broadening of the spiritual and magical spectrum of the book as well. And that's where we start getting the judging eye. We start getting, of course, the White Luck Warrior, which is what the second book in this Aspect Emperor series is named after. We start learning a bit more about them. So the world has widened up. We find out more about different different parts of the world, of Eowa, or whatever the continent that all this takes place is based in. So that's all I really have to say about this book for now. It did have a very abrupt ending, and I do look forward to reading the second book in this trilogy. Hopefully we'll continue on the same high level. It's really weird to give this a rating, because like if it was just a standalone book, like so many standalone books, like these fantasy books are, you start reading them in the first book in a series, or you think they're going to be a standalone book, and then they surprise you with being a first book in a series and with no resolution and with no answers and just introducing the characters. And that's what I find with quite a lot of these first books in series that I've read. But this, it's not a first book in the series. It's just a nice continuation of a previous story, even though it's set 20 years later. And I know the next book is already out. So if it was a standalone book, it would be like, what, 3 stars or something. But I'm going to give it 4 stars just because I really, really enjoy the writing style. I really enjoy the characters. I really enjoy like every second paragraph, it seems, to be a contemplation of some philosophical thought in every way that a character suddenly looks at something different. It's sort of like a clever way. Of course, R. Scott Bakker is, I think, some philosophy student or professor or writer, or but he is definitely a philosopher, because everything that he turns his eye to, it sounds like I'm reading some kind of cynic collection of sayings, or some Gnostic collection of sayings of talking about, you know, reflecting the spirituality of these hidden aspects of the world and bringing them out through the mundane, and then doing the same thing by using the mundane to reflect on these great philosophical topics. And I really enjoy that style of writing, and I've never really read another author who does it quite in the same style as R. Scott Baker. And I think that's why these will never work as audiobooks, because every like third paragraph that you read, you just go, oh, wait a second, let me think about that a bit. That's really clever. And then you move on to the next one. It's not all great. I mean, a lot of it is quite basic stuff, but it's that he just keeps doing it and can keep reflecting on so many different aspects of life and the different turns of phrase that he uses. Maybe I'm going to see if I wrote any down here. I'll bring out my notes on my iPhone, because I do like to keep some notes. Did I make any here? Solaris? No, there's some for Solaris and Children of Men, but I don't have any notes from this book. But it was, like I say, it's a lot of fun to read. He does have this command of language and a command of metaphor and a command of analogy, which is which I think is very, I haven't seen it matched very often. It is in other books, but here it's done very well. And I think that's the point of these books. All of the time, all it's talking about, I mean, sure, they're fighting with swords and they're going through the mines of Moria, but, you know, there's so many different levels going on. And I think actually the parts of this book that I didn't like so much, like I say, this long trip into the mines of Moria, it felt like a lot of that was disappearing. And of course, it was talking about the writing of the gnomen who dug the mines, and that they can't see pictures. They can only see three-dimensional inscriptions and things like that. And it's talking about sight and light and in ways, and it's talking about knowledge, but like the Mines of Moria trope, I think it sort of fell a bit short. And I actually like it more when he's just talking about mundane people doing mundane stuff and reflecting on the life and talking about groups of people moving together and the interplay of characters. And that was sort of missing a bit from the Mines of Moria sequence. And also, I say, it doesn't really have an end. It just finishes, and I'm like, okay, well, sure, this character's still alive, and this character's still alive, and this character's still alive. He hasn't killed anyone, and there's not been any rape, which is really strange. Or maybe there was one rape, but it was this weird male victim rape, female raping male, not quite sure what was going on there, some weird spiritual or religious magical ceremony, black magic ceremony going on there. So I wasn't quite sure, but I was expecting a lot more rape, because that's what R. Scott Baker normally does feature in his fantasy books, but not a lot here. Anyway, yeah, I don't think I've got much to say. 4 stars. Keep up the good work, R. Scott Baker. I'm looking forward to ordering the next book in this series. I might just get it as an ebook and read it there, or I'll just order it from Amazon, because it won't be coming out. I don't expect it to be coming out in paperback for a while, so I think an ebook or paperback book from Amazon is the best idea. So that's it for now. The next book that I will be reviewing, I will be doing a proper review of it. It's Solaris by Stanislav Lem, and the book after that could be Terminal World by Alistair Reynolds. We'll see how that goes. But please email me. I've had loads of really great emails. I've replied to most of them. There's one or two emails outstanding that I've not got to reply to yet. I've only got my iPhone for doing internet stuff at the moment. Wi-Fi is working really well on my iPhone, but I'm in France, and the only Wi-Fi point that there is here at the French convention is this thing that only works with mobile phones, because it's a mobile phone company supplying it, and it has to register it. So my laptop isn't connecting, but I am still getting emails, so please email me, luke@juggler.net. I love getting into discussions with people about all kinds of stuff, about science fiction. Yeah, actually, someone said, emailed me before saying, hey, did you really mean it that you liked getting into conversations about politics? I said, no, it's not that I like political conversations. It's just that I find them interesting, as long as it's not one person trying to convince me to become a libertarian continuously. Those get tired quite quickly, because there are no new arguments about libertarianism that I find interesting or compelling or even slightly convincing or intellectually honest or intellectually rigorous in a way. And just because I read books which, you know, about some topics about libertarianism and different things like that, it doesn't mean that I am interested in being converted to an ideology in any way. But I do enjoy debating different topics, and so please, not debating, having conversations, because debating means that I think we should be changing each other's minds or trying to convince other people that our views are correct. I'd much rather just a conversation where we can just email back and forth with no pressure and no stress. So if you want to know my thoughts about anything, please email me Luke at juggler.net. And if you've got any book recommendations, the best way to do that, keep track of them, is please just suggest them to me via goodreads.com. And even if it's already on my to read list or recommended by SFBRP listeners list, please just keep sending it in. Otherwise, follow me on Twitter. That's it. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.